This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The UN's largest peacekeeping mission reached its culmination last week when Cambodians went to the polls to elect a new National Assembly. The Assembly is to draft a constitution within 3 months. But it's uncertain whether the ruling party will honor the vote and give up power. And it's unclear what the UN will do next. Its mandate ends in 3 months. This is almost a test case of the UN's peacekeeping abilities. The UN sent a 22,000-member peacekeeping force after brokering a 1991 peace treaty. The treaty followed 14 years of civil war. My guest Dan Sesser just returned from Cambodia. He writes about Southeast Asia for The New Yorker, and he has a new book called The Lands of Charm and Cruelty: Travels Through Southeast Asia. The election in Cambodia had a shockingly high turnout of 90%, but the story hardly ends there.
The question is what the election meant. What did the 90% turnout mean? That the peasantry of Cambodia, only 10% of the people of Cambodia live in Phnom Penh, and 70% of the people who live in Phnom Penh hadn't been there over a long period of time. The city was evacuated by the Khmer Rouge. Most of the people are peasants. The intelligentsia of Cambodia was completely wiped out by the Khmer Rouge. Almost no one survived with university degrees, doctors, lawyers, anyone else. And the question is whether what the election meant, whether it meant that Cambodia is now going to be a democracy and things are going to be done by the ballot box, or whether once again, the Khmer Rouge will start attacking, the central government will be corrupt and factionalized, and things will fall back into the pattern it did before.
So in a way, the big question happens now, like, will people accept the results of the election or not? And if not, what's the point of having them?
Well, the question is whether the Hun Sen government will accept the results of the election. The Hun Sen government went into this whole thing thinking it could win, or that it could intimidate people into winning. Hun Sen himself is very much of a moderate, but he doesn't really control the government. He's more of a figurehead. The person who really controls the government behind the scenes is a man named Chea Sim, who's an old hardline Stalinist. And the government is not about to give up power, and particularly not about to give up their army, which is not really Cambodia's national army, but is the army of the old Communist Party, and the source of their strength. Well, the Hun Sen government thought that it could sweep the elections through a campaign of intimidation. Dozens of opposition figures were murdered. The United Nations stood back, basically, and watched this all happen without doing very much. And they were as shocked as anyone else when there was this huge voter turnout, and the huge turnout meant that a lot of the opposition came out, that the opposition wasn't, people who supported the opposition were not intimidated, and they came out to vote, and they voted for the other faction, the royalists, backing Prince Sihanouk.
So what are the signs now about whether the government in power now will accept the elections or not?
Well, the government itself is very factionalized. Hun Sen has said that he will accept the elections, but his spokesman then said, well, we'll accept the elections, but we'll never give up the army. Well, if they don't give up the army, then there's no one to fight the Khmer Rouge. It's something that's probably going to be settled not by the legislature that the people just elected, but in some sort of backroom deal behind the scenes. And what's most likely is that a sort of coalition will be formed between the Hun Sen government and the royalist opposition, who will agree to split the booty. Cambodia is growing very prosperous. It's just amazing to go to Phnom Penh, and I ate at a restaurant that was 20 minutes from the center of Phnom Penh, but the restaurant cost $2 million to open, and there were like 100 tables, and 3 of them were filled. But Thai investors have come in and just poured hundreds of millions of dollars into Cambodia, looking upon Cambodia as a future Thai economic colony. And there's so much money leading to so much graft and corruption that I think that the corruption that's been generated can support both factions. And both of the leading factions are notoriously corrupt.
So do you think that the election won't change the corruption in the government of Cambodia?
That's certain, because the three parties that ran in the election, or the three major parties, there were 20 parties, but only three got a substantial number of votes. And all of them are notoriously corrupt. The Hun Sen government has just raked in tens of millions of dollars in every sort of scheme. The Sihanoukis, when Prince Sihanouk was in power in the 1950s and 60s, his government was notoriously corrupt. The third faction, the American-backed Khmer People's National Liberation Front, the KP, they're simply a group of warlords. I was in a town in Cambodia last month controlled by the KP, and the local warlord was a multimillionaire. He had houses all over the world, and he was getting rich because the road in that area had been upgraded by the American AID money. And since it was now a good road, that road could be used to smuggle things into Thailand. Everyone's getting rich. The only honest people running in the election were the small minor parties, which won't be represented at all in the legislature.
The Khmer Rouge boycotted the elections, and they threatened a campaign of terror against them. What were the results of that campaign? I mean, there was a campaign of terror right before the elections, but not during the actual vote.
No one knows why this happened. There are a couple of good guesses, but the Khmer Rouge did have the country terrorized 2 weeks before the elections. It was just remarkable. The streets of Phnom Penh emptied out at dark. I was in Siem Reap, the city that's right next to the ruins of Angkor Wat, 1 week after the Khmer Rouge shot it up. And I and two other journalists were the only Westerners there, and we had the ruins entirely to ourselves, and people were literally shaking, expecting a huge attack at any moment. The attack never came, and no one knows why, but there's a good theory, and it's really interesting. In northwest Cambodia, near Siem Reap, but closer to the Thai border, which is controlled by the Khmer Rouge, people were actually trucked in by the local Khmer Rouge commanders, were trucked to the nearest UN polling place so that they could vote for the royalist faction, the Sihanoukis, the opposition to the Hun Sen government. And this was astonishing, because the Khmer Rouge had said that they weren't going to participate, and they were going to try to block the elections any way they could. And then they were trucking in people to vote. But in the south of the country, in another area where the Khmer Rouge are strong, they shot up polling places. They killed a couple of UN soldiers. So the indications are that the Khmer Rouge themselves might be factionalized, might be disagreeing with the future course of events. Everyone assumes that Pol Pot is sitting comfortably in his home in Thailand directing this whole effort with the same sort of thing that happened during the late 70s when the Khmer Rouge ruled Cambodia and murdered all the people, and there was no dissent allowed in any way. But it appears that the Khmer Rouge may not be as united as people are thinking. And in Siem Reap, it was very interesting. When the Khmer Rouge took over the city, and then the news report said that the government troops came in and drove them out the next day. But in fact, the UN people there told me that that's not what happened at all, that the government troops fled at the first sound of shooting, and the Khmer Rouge had the city completely under their control, and then they withdrew voluntarily. And apparently, the Khmer Rouge army isn't strong enough to control a big urban area like Siem Reap, a city of perhaps 20, 30,000 people. People say that the Khmer Rouge army is down to about 12,000 men, which is enough to control jungle and mountain territory, but not enough to control major cities. So the Khmer Rouge are perfectly capable of inflicting terror, but it's a question of whether they're still this monolithic force that they used to be that's capable of taking over the country.
Since the Khmer Rouge are basically in hiding, right, how do you keep up with what they're doing? How do you know?
Well, the Khmer Rouge have adapted to modern times. They now actually have a press spokesman who holds press conferences in a city near the Thai border, and reporters go over from Thailand to attend the press conferences. And they have a sort of public relations effort. Nate Thayer, who's the correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review in Phnom Penh, has good enough sources so that he can actually pick up a telephone and call Khmer Rouge people and ask them questions. They've been very secretive in the past, and there's a question about whether they're being honest in what they talk about now, but it's actually possible to reach them. And one day in a town in northwest Cambodia called Tamarpok, I was actually able to sit down and have lunch with a bunch of Khmer Rouge soldiers, and through someone who spoke Khmer, to ask them questions. In the past, an American journalist would not have survived that sort of experience.
Do you think that the Khmer Rouge might become more mainstream as a result of this election?
I don't think so, because I think the election has been successful enough to freeze the Khmer Rouge out of the political process. In other words, that the two main factions, the Hun Sen government and the Sihanoukis, have felt confident enough from the election results to not incorporate the Khmer Rouge into any further factions. The Khmer Rouge will now have to gain whatever they can gain by fighting. And it's going to be a lot more difficult than it's been in the past because they no longer have Chinese support. They still have Thai support to some extent, but the Khmer Rouge no longer has Chinese support, and the Chinese were funneling money and arms to the Khmer Rouge all during the 1980s. So they're going to be fighting from a weakened position. I think they took a gamble in trying to disrupt the peace process, and they lost. And I think for the while they're going to be weakened. That's not to say, though, that they can't inflict tremendous terror on the country, and that will have serious consequences in terms of investment and just the psychology of how people feel about their country and government. But it's not going to be as easy as it once would have been to take over Cambodia again.
Stan Sesser is my guest. He writes about Southeast Asia for The New Yorker magazine, and he has a new book called The Lands of Charm and Cruelty, Travels in Southeast Asia. Stan, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stan Sesser, who writes about Southeast Asia, and he just came back from Cambodia. There was about a 90% voter turnout in the election in Cambodia. Why do you think so many people turned out?
Well, it's one interesting thing. I think there are three factors, and one of the interesting things is the UN ran a terrific election. They could be criticized for lots of things, but not for the way they put the election together. The first thing they did was they gave everyone a plastic embossed identity card with their picture on it. And most of the people in Cambodia have never even seen their own photograph. The chance to get this official-looking card was so appealing that people were lined up to register to vote because they wanted an identity card. And some voting workers told me that people would come back the next day and say that they didn't like their picture. Could they get another card that maybe would have a more flattering pose of them? The UN brought in televisions to people who'd never seen televisions and ran VCR programs about the election. They brought in comic books. This is a country where there is no entertainment. You can't go to the 10-screen local movie house at night. There's nothing to do in Cambodia. And suddenly there was all this entertainment. And the UN did a wonderful job in making the election entertaining, and a lot of people registered to vote. The second thing about the turnout was that the Hun Sen government is really resented. And a lot of people are, you know, that Cambodia is a desperately poor country. Suddenly money starts flooding in because the peace process makes investment safer than it was before. And all the money goes into the pockets of political officials. So it becomes a desperately poor country with the top half percent suddenly driving Mercedes and BMWs. People were enormously resentful of this, and that brought out a lot of opposition vote, the hatred of the government. And the third thing is that the government did a lot of intimidation and brought out their own supporters. They bought off village leaders who instructed their people to vote and whatever. But I actually think that the major factor was that this was a real happening, that this was something everyone in Cambodia was talking about, an event unlike anything that had ever happened before. And for a month, it was the local people's form of entertainment.
Where were you on the days of the elections?
Well, in the UN had everything controlled. I think, you know, because the UN thought that the election was going to be a questionable enterprise, they had starting 5 days before the election, they didn't allow reporters to board helicopters and go to other places. So the reporters mostly stayed in Phnom Penh or drove to other cities. I actually left the country a couple of days before the election because it was so boring. There was just nothing to do but to attend UN press briefings. The interesting thing was during the Khmer Rouge attacks, when the UN helicopters were open to any reporters who wanted to go, and I was able actually to go into Khmer Rouge territory It was a chance to see parts of Cambodia that normally wouldn't be accessible. But during the election itself, it was a very, very tightly controlled thing. I think if the UN had known that 90% of the people would come out to vote, that reporters would have been allowed a lot more freedom in going around the country.
The UN mandate expires in 3 months. What happens next? What are the UN's options?
Well, The real question is, since the opposition, what was elected by the voters was a constituent assembly, and the idea is that they meet, draw up a constitution for Cambodia, form a new government, and in 3 months the UN goes away and this government takes over. Well, it's clear that the Hun Sen government wants a piece of the action. They're not going to withdraw and turn their army over to the Sihanoukers, who have traditionally been their enemies. So the UN, one thing that's going to happen is it's likely that the UN mandate will be extended indefinitely. There'll be a UN presence. There has to be a UN presence or Cambodia is going to fall apart. Then the second thing that's going to happen is that there will be attempt to form a coalition between the Sihanoukers and the Hun Sen government. And if there is a coalition, then they can fight the Khmer Rouge and Cambodia will be pretty stable. If the Hun Sen government decides it doesn't want a coalition, that it somehow wants control of everything, then there's going to be war with the UN in the middle. And the Sihanoukers don't have an army, really. When they were on the border, they depended on the Khmer Rouge army. The United States gave money to the Sihanoukers and the KPNLF, which in turn channeled the money to the Khmer Rouge, whose troops protected all three factions. But now there's just a small Khmer Rouge army of 12,000 and a large government army of over 100,000. And if the government refuses to give up its army, it's going to be interesting because the opposition doesn't have troops to fight the government, and the UN has 16,000 troops, and the UN is going to be in a real bind. So the hope is that some sort of coalition can be negotiated behind the scenes.
Your new book is titled The Lands of Charm and Cruelty, and you write about how you are constantly exposed to both in Southeast Asia, and what an incredible contradiction it is.
It is. It's hard to believe. When you go to places like Cambodia and Burma and you see these really remarkably open and friendly people, so considerate of each other, so considerate of visitors, smiling all the time, doing things that are so admirable in their society, for instance, taking care of all their aged relatives and you know, having such consideration for their families and for guests. And then you see these absolutely brutal governments. These two things are existing side by side, and you wonder how you meet Cambodians on the street and you really just fall in love with the Cambodian people, and yet this is the country that produced the Khmer Rouge, which exterminated 1.5 million of their own people. And this contradiction between the charm and cruelty that goes on in these countries is astonishing. People have tried to explain it to me, I've talked to experts on Buddhism who've, you know, told me how these two trends can be interwoven into the Buddhist religion, but I've never totally understood it. It's far more complex than the fatalism of Buddhism, the idea that the individual and the individual's fate is controlled by some higher force. It's far more complex than that. But to see these two things going on side by side is really shocking.
Stan Sesser, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
Stan Sesser writes about Southeast Asia for The New Yorker. He's also the author of the new book, The Lands of Charm and Cruelty, Travels in Southeast Asia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.